Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, December 18th. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Day today, and Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson are back to answer your calls. Comet 3I Atlas, now pretty much determined to be a comet, is making its nearest appearance to the Earth, I think, tonight or in the overnight hours. You want to talk about that? That's good. What the heck is with this lemon-shaped planet with possibly a diamond core? That's interesting. We'll talk about that, too. Anything you want about astronomy is on the table. 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or email your astronomical inquiries to voxpop@wamc.org. Bob Berman, Valerie Rapson, and your calls coming up on Astronomy Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Day today, and we have our resident astronomers in-house to answer your questions about the final frontier. Bob Berman has written a couple of dozen astronomy books. He's the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her Ph.D. in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. If you have a question for our team today, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And a few people have done that already, but feel free. 800-348-2551, once again, is the number. Valerie Rapson, you're done with another semester.
Yes, grades are in and everything is all set.
And you feel relaxed and...
You know, I finally have time to think. Like, during the semester, it's just so busy. You're always worried about teaching the next class and what assignments you got to grade and all of that. But during break, it's like... I can think about my projects and my research for like a whole day with nobody bothering me about anything else.
And then, well, you know, there's always somebody not connected to the college to bother you.
So,
it's tough to get just a full day of whatever you want to do. Now, does the planetarium and the observatory, the telescope, go dark during the
they
holiday
do.
Break?
We take a little break because my students will do the work for us over the on the weekends. So since they're gone, we usually take a little break. But we'll be back in February, and then we run all summer long now. So we get most of the year.
Oh, that's great. And last time you were here, you were talking about some gizmo that you had that takes photographs.
The sea star, yeah.
Yeah, and so how's that? You played
with it?
It's
been so much fun. I've only had a chance to take it out twice because it's been so cloudy lately.
Yeah.
But it's taking really pretty pictures, and we're actually going to try and work with some scientists at RIT to take pictures of potential nebula that have never been seen before.
Ooh,
around
cool.
Dead stars, and we're going to see if this simple telescope can do it. We're not sure it's going to work, but it's something I'm going to test out over break.
Bob Berman, I know that you're feeling fairly flush at the moment as you got a royalty check for one of your books, so if you can lend us a couple bucks, that's fine. You know, what book was that from? Did it say?
Oh, it was one of the biocentrism books.
Ah, okay, good. You know, the last couple that you haven't written one in 4 or 5 years, right?
Right.
The last couple were sensational.
Well, thank you.
Did they sell?
Yeah. Well enough that there was a time when the royalty checks were actually exciting to open, and they really meant something. We should let our listeners in on the joke that when Ray says that he just got an exciting royalty check, it was for $29.
Well, it's better than $0. Well, you know, there is stuff going on. Comet 3I Atlas is making its closest pass to Earth, which is what? It's millions and millions of miles away.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have a chance to see this thing with the naked eye?
No. Gosh, no. It's like 2,000 times too faint to actually see it with our eyes, unfortunately. Yeah, but it's going to pass by at about 1 a.m., and they're doing a live stream. There's a couple observatories that are going to watch it with their telescopes. So if you're up between the hours of like 11 a.m. and 2 a.m., they're going to live stream the whole thing. So,
you know, there's been so much chit chat about this, which I think ultimately is good for astronomy because it gets people thinking about the sky and looking at the sky. I've looked at some of these photographs from various telescopes and whatnot. Where are the good pictures? They're all fuzzy. It can't do any better than this.
Yeah, that's the problem, right? I mean, it's far away, like you said, and it's small. It's only like, you know, 1,000 feet wide or something. So you're not going to get good pictures of this tiny little dark blob. Yeah. They're always going to be little and fuzzy.
Well, you know, the one that really caught my eye, and I have the Twitter feed for, I think it's space.com. James Webb Space Telescope discovers a lemon-shaped exoplanet unlike anything seen before. What the heck is this? That's the headline. Mm-hmm. And Valerie, you and Bob have had a chance to talk this out a little bit. First of all, you studied exoplanets, so tell us what you think, Valerie.
Yeah, so the basics behind this is you've got a Jupiter-sized planet, so it's a gas giant planet, but it's not orbiting a regular star, it's orbiting a pulsar. So basically the core of a massive star that died and exploded, and all that's left is this fast-spinning neutron star that pulses light. And they found this planet that's so close to the pulsar that it's being, like, pulled by its gravity, so it stretches out into that lemon shape, and it has this strange atmosphere. It's, like, all carbon and nothing else, and not, like, carbon compounds, just pure carbon, diatomic carbon, C3, like, nothing else that you would expect in an atmosphere.
It's so weird, but... Now, Bob, the pulsar was an exploded planet. This thing's very close. What are the odds that this so-called lemon-shaped planet is actually a remnant of this explosion of the star?
I doubt it, because pulsars are so incredibly dense. A teaspoonful of, change that, a tablespoon of pulsar material weighs the same as 10 fully loaded cement trucks. So it's such a dense object. In fact, neutron stars or pulsars are the densest visible objects in the universe. Only black holes can do them better. So they're exciting by themselves ever since 1966 when Jocelyn Bell discovered the first one. They're amazing objects, but for a piece of it to break off, can't really break off because the gravity is too strong. It's really glued to the surface, so you don't get like a flying out piece that suddenly condenses. And if it condenses, imagine an object that would be as dense as this planet would be, then you wouldn't just have helium and carbon floating in the atmosphere. You'd have other weird things happen if it was a piece of pulsar material.
But Valerie, this thing, this planet, is very close to this pulsar.
Right.
Assuming that the star blew up once, wouldn't it have obliterated this planet?
Right. Well, that's the weird thing is, like, we don't really know where it came from. You know, like Bob said, it's probably not a piece of the star.
Right.
It might have existed before the pulsar exploded and somehow survived. It could have formed from the remnant material, but that close to the pulsar, that seems unlikely. So we're still trying to figure it out. And the fact that there's literally only carbon in the upper atmosphere, and I think maybe a little helium or something that doesn't bind well with carbon, that's very strange. Because if you think of Earth's atmosphere, it's mostly nitrogen and oxygen. And we see that in other gas giant planets too. But that material, they think it must be like bound inside the planet, or maybe it just doesn't exist in that atmosphere for some strange reason.
Bob.
And just to be clear, we said a few times that the pulsar exploded. Pulsars cannot explode. What happened is the pulsar formed when a very massive star exploded, and the core of that star became the pulsar, shrunk, actually collapsed, not exploded, did the opposite to become the pulsar.
But yet this planet is a million miles from the pulsar.
Yeah, that's pretty far out, that because pulsars have such incredible gravity. And by the way, they have, most of them, incredible magnetic fields, too. Mm-hmm. So that normally a magnetic field can hurt you, but it turns out that when you get a magnetic field a trillion times stronger than Earth's, you're talking about things a lot worse if you were there than just having your credit cards chips erased by the magnetic field. You're talking about your actual atoms being stretched into weird shapes that are incompatible with life.
Is that why this thing is in a lemon shape?
It could be. I mean, the lemon shape is probably not from the magnetic field, but mostly just from the gravitational forces. But we don't know exactly how far the magnetic field extends, so it could be influencing the planet a little bit.
No, I'm confused. Bob, you said it was pretty far, a million miles.
A million miles.
We're 93 million miles from our sun, and it wasn't as big as that. Isn't it a million miles very close?
They're all 12 miles in diameter. Interestingly, when neutron stars or pulsars collapse, they stop at 12 miles in diameter because you have a neutron degeneracy pressure. It's a subatomic effect. that quantum mechanics tells us you can't have two things occupying the same space at the same time. And so that's what stops the collapse. It's bewildering because this is the same process that a little bit more mass in this object and it would keep shrinking and become a black hole.
Right.
So it's the intermediate step that just stops short. And those listeners who might have a backyard telescope, if you want to see a neutron star, there's actually one that's visible with backyard telescopes, and that's in the heart of the Crab Nebula, out these nights in the constellation Taurus. And with a nice 8-inch telescope, you'll actually see the neutron star. That's the one neutron star you can see from your backyard.
Now, speaking of black holes, Valerie, we both saw this story about a black hole, renegade black hole that's going so fast I can't even fathom it. Tell us about that.
It literally got kicked out of its galaxy.
Well,
they're trying to figure that out. They see this galaxy that appears to be like a whole spiral galaxy, and it has like a super long tail behind it. And what they figured out is at the front of the tail, there's actually a million solar mass black hole that's creating a shock wave and like dragging material with it. So we think this black hole got kicked out of the system, and that galaxy that we observe must have been two galaxies that collided with one another. And the black hole, when it collided, they think the gravitational waves from the collision when it merged actually created a push and kicked it out of the galaxy.
Have we ever seen anything like this before?
No. I mean, a lot of astronomers have been looking deep in the center of galaxies to look for what they call kicked black holes, where the black hole's maybe not right at the middle, but slightly off center, so there's some sort of interaction going on. But we've never seen one actually get thrown out of its galaxy before.
And this thing's moving extremely fast.
Yeah, like at millions of miles per hour, I think it said. It was
crazy.
Nuts.
Bob.
And again, for our listeners who have backyard telescopes, if you want to see the, your best bet black hole, well, there is a star, HD226868, in Cygnus that orbits around a black hole every 6.5 days. But your best bet is, again, out late these nights, is the galaxy M87. On its northwest side, there is a famous jet of material that's traveling at near light speed. In fact, there's some controversy that it might be going faster than light, but turns out, since it's coming slightly toward us, it gives the illusion of faster than the speed of light. It's being created by a supermassive black hole that weighs at least 9 billion times what the sun does.
Wow.
That's spitting it out. So that's visible easily with any size backyard telescope.
Okay, let's take a quick break here. It's Astronomy with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. We'll get to your calls. And this is not appropriate music in any way. It's a man and a woman. 800-348-2551. Well, I mean, there is a man and a woman there. Okay, fine. Let's take a break, and then we'll sort this all out. One 800-348-2551 is the number. It's Astronomy. Sure, that's okay. Voxpop at WAMC.org if you want to email us. And we'll go through a couple emails now, and then we'll hit the phones in a moment. This one from Ben in Providence. I'm a regular listener. I've noticed we keep talking about all these interstellar objects like 3I Atlas and Oumuamua. Are these objects a new phenomenon, or is there just some new piece of technology that astronomers created that makes it easier to see them? If so, can you explain what makes it the technology so special?
It's really an issue of that previously all comets were solar system objects. They came from the Oort cloud or the Kuiper belt. You could trace their orbits back. They had elliptical, and some of them had hyperbolic orbits, but they showed that they originated in the solar system, the far reaches of the solar system. The new thing is the discovery of orbits that show they had to have come from beyond the solar system. So it's very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Well, Valerie, getting to Ben's question, is there something in technology over the last several years? Presumably, this is not the first and second or third time this has happened.
Right,
this
probably is, not.
But now we've caught a few in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a reason why?
Well, one of the things we have nowadays are these big survey telescopes that are constantly monitoring all parts of the sky as much as possible. So we're able to see more objects and catch them earlier. So we can track their periods and we can see how they're moving around the sun and realize that they have those strange hyperbolic orbits and are probably from interstellar space. So we have that, and we have, you know, larger telescopes and James Webb being infrared. That allows us to see things that are smaller and colder much more easily, so we can study them in more detail. So it's possible that many of them have come in before and we just didn't happen to catch them, especially if they didn't get super close to the sun or super close to the Earth. But now, since we're surveying the sky more consistently, we're catching them more often.
Mm-hmm. This one, Bob, I know we've talked about this in the past. Nick writes in, what is that diagonal line of stars below and to the left of Orion's belt that are seemingly in order of diminishing brightness? I thought it was to the right, though. It's that extra belt sort of.
Well, this is one of those things that when people say, what is that quadrangle? What is that triangle? What is that thing near Orion? No. When you actually go out in the sky, you can find, depending upon how little or how big of the sky you're taking in, you can find crosses, squares, triangles, lines of every kind. So I just wish that the caller could come to one of my observatories or visit Valerie, and if we had you with us, we'd say, oh, this is what it is. But describing it the way you're saying, to the left of Orion and Orion's belt, you mainly get to Canis Major and the brightest star in the sky, Sirius. And Sirius has a number of beautiful, bluish, fairly bright stars around it with lovely names. Just great names. But I won't keep going. The point is, there's no shape that, to my mind, matches what the caller just said.
Well, okay, then I don't think he described it correctly. There's the big three that are in the belt, right?
Right.
Okay, and then I believe it's to the right. I saw this the other night. There's another small, very similar in shape to the big three. They're very small, and they're angled a different way, but they're right there. They're always right next to the big three. Do you know?
It could be just, you know, stars in the Orion Nebula region that he's seeing, because you'll see the trapezium very brightly, so it could be that.
I got to find a picture of this during the break, and I will show
you. That's almost perpendicular to the belt, not to the right of the belt.
But but I mean, of course, but it's not the same. It's not going parallel to the belt.
No, it's perpendicular to it.
Yeah, and so I think that is what our writer is talking about.
We'll have to look.
All right, the number is 800-348-2551.
Ray can answer these questions.
I don't know what it is, man. I mean, we were joking about it the other night. We're looking at the stars. I said, I think that's part of the quiver, but I wasn't sure.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, when you're thinking about the arm and holding like the bow and arrow.
But
type
I wasn't.
Thing.
I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if it has a specific name, but that could be it.
All right. So this is from Gracie in Sheffield, and then we'll go to the phones. This is actually, I love this question. Gracie writes, I think it is particles that act differently if they know they're being observed. How does this relate to the Mona Lisa, who they say smiles as you're walking away?
But doesn't smile otherwise.
Yeah. All right, Bob.
Have we all visited the Louvre and seen the Mona Lisa?
No.
Smaller,
I've never even heard this.
Smaller than you expect, more crowded than you had hoped wouldn't be the case. And generally, you go away from the Mona Lisa with a feeling that it's overrated, that it's got a nice painting, but is it the best painting in the world? No, not even close. Does she not smile when no one's looking?
Well, how do you know you're not looking?
I keep thinking of those pictures, you know, they have those images nowadays where you walk by and it changes depending on the angle you see it at. Like, that's what I'm thinking of here.
All right. Well, Gracie, we're going to have to leave that one, but thank you for that. 800-348-2551. Let's go to Douglas in Saratoga. Douglas, you're on.
Hey, thanks, Ray, for having these amazing shows with your guests.
Thank you.
I'm a retired school teacher quite some time ago. I have always kind of guessed in my own mind that I could kind of predict how big the sun actually is. And is there any way to actually, you know, let kids know how big it is? But my question always was, do we have any kind of ideas or even guesstimates as to how long the sun might continue to burn the way it does or explode or any of that kind of thing because our very survival on Earth depends upon it.
Yeah, 3 hours, Douglas. Three or four hours.
May I jump in on this? There's actually two figures here that you need to know about. One is 1.1 billion years in the future, which is when solar experts predict the sun will be 10% hotter than it is now, hotter and brighter. It has actually brightened up or gotten more luminous by 10% every billion years, and Earth has compensated. Our atmosphere has changed in its thickness and in other ways, and we've been able to survive it. But all the experts, which is not me in this case, say that we cannot, Earth cannot survive another 10%. So that's 1.1 billion years in the future. If we manage to survive that, which we won't, because Earth is predicted then to reach a worldwide temperature of 700 degrees Fahrenheit, which will boil the oceans off, and et cetera. But if somehow we survive that, then 4.5 billion years in the future, which interestingly enough is the same figure that we have, that we Earth has been alive in the past, maybe even the sun has been alive in the past, the sun will then grow up to be a red giant. And that's a famous outcome, unfortunately, and that Earth will be either right on the edge of orbiting it or maybe even be slightly inside it. And that, too, will reduce property values here on Earth. So you can take your pick which of those solar events you wish to list as the final one.
And how confident, Valerie, are scientists of that timeline?
Yeah, we're pretty confident. Since we have the sun so close, we have a pretty good understanding of what it's made of, what's happening on the inside, and we've done tons of models of stars that are similar in size to the sun, and they always end up dying, you know, between 10 and 12 billion years from now. So we can look at the properties of the sun, match them up with exactly what the models say, and figure out, you know, where are we in the process and what's going to happen in the future.
So, Douglas, thanks for that one. I think we have a little time to worry about it. Now, what if, and Bob says, you know, we might be at the edge here at the Earth when it goes red giant, mm-hmm. or we might be swallowed up. What about some of these rocky moons of the gas giants that are way far mm-hmm. away? Might they end up in the Goldilocks zone?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're talking, you know, Europa around Jupiter, Enceladus around Saturn. Right now they have liquid water oceans, but the whole moon might turn into a liquid ocean and we could maybe go live there, or at least maybe not humans,
enough
but
to
life
mention
would survive.
Mars itself, perhaps.
True.
Perhaps.
But I thought, okay, so that was my first thought. And Mars is how many million miles away from Earth?
About 45 million. Oh, from Earth? 38 million.
So that's 100 some odd million, 120, 130.
Yeah, and you might argue that that's awfully close to the new sun's surface. But on the other hand, the new sun's surface won't be as luminous as our present spectral class G star's surface is. So it might be that Mars might be in the Goldilocks zone.
Okay, but I thought that we had decided that Mars didn't have A, the good magnetic field, and B, didn't have the mass to keep the atmosphere. So isn't that a non-starter?
That's not good.
Yeah, that's not going to change with the sun, you know, getting bigger. It's only going to make it worse. And, you know, we don't think that there's that much water there. So even if you could get past the atmosphere stuff, like, you don't have the high abundance of water that you need. So I think those moons are much better.
You can't change it. No mass is no mass.
Roberto Duran. Right. Yes. Let's go to Joyce in Brattleboro. Almost called you Juice. Anybody ever do that?
No.
Okay. Well, there's a first for everything. You're on.
Okay. My question is, I'm really interested in what I hear about the tons of space debris that's out circulating around the Earth. And as a naturopathic physician, I find it very interesting that we now are concerned about all the microplastic particles that have penetrated everything. And the question is any of the space debris, is there any possibility of any of this space debris ending up down in the air on the Earth?
Yes, the short answer is yes. And this is one of the things we're worried about with, like, the Starlink satellites and all of that, because they're only designed to last, you know, 5 years or so, and then we deorbit them. Yeah, they're not designed to last too long because the new technology comes up, so they want to get a new satellite up there. But as they deorbit, you know, those metals that they're made of, they end up in the atmosphere. And we're just now starting to do some more studies as to how that's going to affect us long term. You know, throw a little titanium oxide or something in the atmosphere, it's not a big deal. But when you've got thousands thousands of deorbited satellites, that's a bigger component than we think of. So we're just now starting to try and figure out those effects.
Bob.
Two things. One, if you want to read more about it, in this new year's 2026 Old Farmer's Almanac, our feature story, we always do only one feature story, and it's about just what the caller is calling about, the junkosphere, and you'll get more details about it. It's a fascinating article, even if I did write it myself. But I want to assuage the fears of our caller, because you should realize that there's more mass of junk, there's more material in a large rock concert such as Burning Man that gets left behind than all of these satellites put together. So it's not like a huge mass of material, because remember, satellites have to be frugal when they're orbited, because their mass has to be kept as low as possible so that they can be launched with the maximum payload for the rocket that's launching them. So there's not a lot of material there that's going to rain down on Earth. You get more in a rock concert what gets left behind.
Joyce, thanks a lot for the call. Wasn't there a group of students who built and successfully launched a satellite made of wood?
I think I saw this too. Now that you mention it. Yeah, like the main component was wood. I mean, it must have been inside of something, because I don't think wood, no matter how much you treat it, is going to survive,
I don't know. Science projects are getting pretty fancy, aren't they?
All right, yeah. I'm sure I saw that. Maybe I imagined it. The number here is 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Dr. Valerie Rapson. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org as well. James is in Saugerties. Hello there, James.
Good afternoon. How are you doing today?
Good. Welcome.
Good. My question is a bit of an extension of what the panel was talking about with the previous gentleman caller. It has to do with the life of the sun and the fate of Earth. So, so we know the sun's going to expand into a red giant and either engulf the Earth or have the Earth just be beyond it. What happens to the Earth? So, if it is engulfed, does it get completely eviscerated and vaporized? There's no more trace of it. If it does survive the sun's life cycle and after it expands into the red giant, how long will the Earth exist as just a rock?
A cinder.
Circling what's left of our sun. How long until it just becomes complete? There's no trace of it whatsoever.
Yeah.
Nobody would ever know it was here.
Yeah, I think initially what we're going to see is the Earth gets scorched, in a sense that we're going to lose our atmosphere. You know, if it gets hot enough, it'll become like a more molten surface like it was in the beginning. And if the sun actually does extend out to engulf it, what will happen is, you know, it'll disrupt Earth's orbit and it will likely spiral down into the core. So it might not, you know, melt or vaporize like we think. It might just kind of circle down in and become part of the star eventually.
You know, we talked about this odd-shaped planet that's only a million miles from this pulsar.
Mm-hmm.
Why hasn't that happened with that?
Well, it must be in a stable orbit. You know, we talked about how a million miles is close, but it's far away because, you know, the pulsar is only 12 miles wide.
But the gravity's high, though, right?
The gravity is strong, so it's clearly distorting it, but it must be in a stable enough orbit to stay there. Or we're just catching it at just the right moment where it is spiraling in, and we're just seeing it, you know, right before it starts to hit the middle.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. How about an email here, and then we will take a break, and then we'll go back to the phones. Once again, the email address is voxpop@wamc.org. Mike in Rexford writes, Valerie, please tell us your initial impressions after using the new C-Star telescope. We talked a little about it, but go ahead. You can expound for a couple minutes.
I thought it was fantastic. So, you know, most telescopes require a lot of setup, and you have to get real specific about how you point it and all of that. This thing, you just turn it on. Set it outside. You have to do a few things in the app to make sure it's connected to the internet, but it does all of the hard stuff itself. So I was just astonished that it was so easy to set up. And the pictures that I got back were just amazing. And because it constantly takes pictures and adds them together, even if you're in a more light polluted area, as long as you let the telescope sit outside for a little while and keep integrating, keep taking those pictures, you get a view as if you were in a really dark sky of what you're looking at.
But the stars appear to move. I mean,
they do. So it's got software that's built in that accounts for that. So the telescope will follow the object, but the telescope, you're going to basically get rotation in your images because of the way the telescope is designed. But the software accounts for that, and actually spins your images, and it just fixes everything.
I totally want one of these. We're not going to say the price, but did the college buy it or did you buy it?
No, the college bought it.
Okay,
but
well,
under my influence.
I love it, Bob. You know, you're an old school astronomer from way back. Not saying you're old, but you're old school. Does it feel like cheating to you to use that?
It feels like cheating to me.
Well, here's the thing. These telescopes, if I want to be an old fogey about it, what I would say is you can't use them to look at the object yourself. You can't get the image of Saturn with its rings and look at it. It only is for photography. Mm-hmm. Now, to me, that's a negative because there's a feeling, a vibe, it sounds hippie-ish, but then again, I live outside of Woodstock, that things have, that celestial objects have. And so I would miss it. Let's put it this way. I wouldn't have it as my only instrument. I would have a telescope that you can observe through. But this instrument, and on several of the tours that I've led, several of the people had them, so I've watched them being used closely. And they are, as Valerie says, astonishing for astrophotography, which is more difficult than visual observing. Mm-hmm. This was the thing that people could not do readily. And now you just set it up and it does it by itself. It tracks. It repeatedly photographs. It finds the object for you. So it makes photography easy. And you end up with an image that you could share or send to people by email. Mm-hmm. And this is a capability that nobody had before.
And Valerie, can you look at using your phone just real time?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, so you're always getting a live image, or you can see the integrated image, like the total result. So but you only get to see it. There's no way to put an eyepiece up to it.
Right. Like I agree with Bob about the feel, and I've always wanted to see Saturn's rings through a telescope.
Right.
I tried.
Because you can find a picture online, and it's basically the same thing. But knowing that, like, you did it, or it's your view from your backyard, like, that's the cool part.
And finding those globular clusters last summer with the binoculars, I felt like the king. I'm
right.
Look at that. Oh, God.
If it does it for you, it is kind of cheating.
All right, let's take a break. 800-348-2551. That's the number. Bob Berman is here. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here. You're over there. Feel free to call here. We got an astronomy show. We have 20 minutes to go. Bernard Pretty Purdy there, and the theme from Shaft on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Ray Graff here. We're joined by Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for another astronomy episode. Last one of 2025.
Ooh.
We'll be back again once a month in 26, so we're looking forward to that. We were joking around. Joyce called. I called her Juice by mistake. You said there's a spacecraft called Juice.
Yeah, the Jupiter Icy Moon Explorer, Juice. It's an ESA mission, a European mission that's headed to Jupiter, and it's going to study Jupiter and mostly its moons to look at those icy moons.
How long does it take to get to Jupiter these days?
It depends on how and when you launch, but usually 5 or 6 years
now,
to get there.
What do you mean how you launch?
Well, so there's different, you know, rocket ships to get you going at a different speed when you release your spacecraft. There's also timing based on, you know, where is Jupiter relative to the Earth when you launch. And if you're going to use the sun to slingshot you, you have to plan all of that out.
But that will ultimately be faster if you slingshot?
Usually, yes, because it's not so much faster, but then you don't have to carry the fuel that you need. To just go from, like, directly Earth to Jupiter or any outer planet, you'd have to burn a ton of fuel to get yourself going in the right direction. But if you slingshot around the sun is your fuel, essentially.
Oh,
you just conserve momentum and energy and use that to go.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Tom in Shutesbury, Massachusetts says, the three stars below and at an angle to Orion's belt, I always heard it was the tip of his sword, which hangs from his belt. Well, that's what we're talking about, Bob. Why didn't you say that earlier?
Well, because they're not in the direction that the caller described.
Well, I think he had it backwards. I went to an observatory in Chapel Hill, says Tom, once, and we were able to view the last star at the tip. It is actually four stars when viewed from a telescope, but appears as a star to the naked eye. Okay. There you go.
Nice. Thank you.
Yeah, that's Epsilon Orionis, and it, Orionis is actually how the Latin genitive should be pronounced, and it's called the Trapezium. Beautiful four-star system that, as Ray just said, dangles from that vertical sword that dangles from the leftmost star, which is Alnilam, Alnilam, Alnitic, Mintica. So Alnilam is the leftmost star, and just straight below it, there's a line of three stars. The middle one is a little fuzzy. Binoculars show it beautifully. That's it.
And that whole quadrant of the sky is great because the Pleiades are over there, too,
yeah.
And it's so much fun.
It's fun for science purposes, too, like in the planetarium, because you've got, you know, stellar birth in the Orion Nebula, you got regular stars in the Pleiades, you got stellar death you can talk about with Betelgeuse and the Crab Nebula. Like, it's all right there for
you. So
you
could
see.
Do a few weeks in the classroom with that.
That's the plan for February
our
planetarium shows is, you know, just talk about it all and use the winter sky as your example.
Don't you want to rest for a little while?
No.
Before that,
no
you
rest.
Want to get right back
no
to
rest.
It.
I already started making the show because I'm excited for those.
Valerie Rapson is here. Bob Berman, it's astronomy. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Michael is in Plattsburgh. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Hello, everybody. Happy holidays. Thanks for taking my call. I tuned in just when the Mona Lisa bit was ending, and it reminded me of something that I saw again last night, and I've noticed for my whole life in the sky, and it is that when I look at particular stars or a cluster, last night was the southwestern sky, they're dimmer when I look straight at them, and a little brighter, more brighter, when I look away.
Rods and
can
cones.
Can you tell me what is this, or is it just me?
Bob.
Yeah, that's the famous averted vision, and that's because the most sensitive cells in our eyes for dim objects are the rod-shaped cells that give us what's called scotopic vision, whereas our normal bright-lit room or outdoor scenery is perceived by our cone-shaped cells that gives us photopic or full color vision. So when you want to see dimmish things, and many of the things in the night sky are dimmish, like the star cluster our caller just described, you must not look directly at it. It's funny that the way to see it is to not look at it. You look slightly off to the side, just a few degrees off to the side, and then the object just pops out at you, because then you're using the area of your retina that has the most rods in it rather than cones in it, and then you really get to see it. In fact, there's a few objects that the ancients all described as none of them described as having seen it at all, and later telescope users saw it. And the key is, if you look at it, you won't see it, but if you look to the side, just the side of it, it pops into view. And there are some star clusters like M44, the Praesepe, also called the Beehive open cluster in the constellation of Cancer, the Crab. It only looks like a slight blur if you look at it. But if you look off to the side, try it sometime. Those of you who know how to find Cancer the Crab, look to the side. And now it's a star cluster. The individual stars are clear as a bell when you look a little to the side of them, but it looks like a blurry, foggy blob if you look right at it.
Amazing. Michael.
Remember this next time I see the Mona Lisa.
Give it a try.
Thank you for the call. Frankly, I think it's just easier to use the sea tracker. What's it called? The
C-Star.
C-Star, yeah. I want to get one of those. Peter in Great Barrington, you're on.
Yes, good afternoon. What a fascinating show. I heard something on YouTube last night about... It seems sort of unbelievable, and I just wanted to check with somebody that actually knows about these things. Signals emanating, like a pair of similar signals coming from the Andromeda galaxy. Does anybody know anything about that?
No, I wouldn't count on YouTube for any astronomy advice.
That's why he's calling to get some confirmation here.
I haven't heard anything about this. You know, I mean, we get signals from galaxies and stars all the time, so it wouldn't
be Andromeda.
Yeah, not Andromeda.
Why?
As much.
Well, it's not a very active galaxy. We have galaxies that are exploding galaxies, like M82. We have safer galaxies that are also violent, have violent cores where all sorts of stuff is happening. You have galaxies that have massive black holes that have, like, the jet in M87. But Andromeda is none of them. It has a supermassive black hole, because all galaxies seem to in their core. But it's not a very popping, cooking galaxy. So it's not giving off stuff in X-rays throughout the spectrum the way some galaxies
but
are.
Yeah,
it's a rather quiet galaxy.
Go ahead, Peter.
Okay. My first question is, what would be a good place for me to search further on this? And if they were saying it was coherent. I mean, it seems so unbelievable that I just said, I don't know about this.
Well, but I mean, we've heard over the
car and I heard you guys talking.
Yeah,
we've heard over the years many times where they said, okay, well, this signal that's coming from X, Y, or Z looks like it could be artificial. And usually, or always, it turns out to be some sort of natural phenomenon. However, getting back to this signal from Andromeda, Bob, I'll ask you, is in fact the light that we see in the RF spectrum, that is radio frequency and everything else, just the fact that we see Andromeda, it is putting out some signal. Yeah.
Well, yeah. It's 2.5 million years old. It took that long to get here. But violence is always the fingerprint of violence are the shorter wavelengths. Like when we see detect gamma rays, X-rays, even ultraviolet rays, we get those from some galaxies where I won't get into some of the details of what causes them, either in the spiral arms or in the cores of galaxies. But you have many galaxies that are more placidly forming. Now, I'm not saying that we're not getting any radio waves from Andromeda. We are. But it's not a place that's a very active galaxy.
Mm-hmm. All right, Peter, thanks a lot for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. And you still have time to squeeze in if you wish. VoxPop@WAMC.org for your emails. Valerie, I've always thought, you know, the visual astronomy, that's the sexy astronomy. What about radio astronomy is important and makes it still viable today?
Well, radio astronomy lets us see a whole bunch of different things. You know, we can track the hydrogen in the galaxy that glows very prominently at radio frequencies, you know, the 21 centimeter line, things like that. We also can look at young stars because their disk of gas and dust that's forming planets is very cold, and we're seeing that glow at radio wavelengths. So now that we have really big radio dishes and multiple dishes that can talk to each other, we can get high resolution images of all of these systems where the material is primarily emitting those radio frequencies of light. We wouldn't be able to see them even if we had, like, you know, the future 30-meter telescope that they want to build. Like, you're not going to be able to see some of these things in the visible range because they just don't glow brightly enough there.
Interesting. You know, Bob, Drake, we were talking about the Drake equation earlier and the SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Maybe that was before the show. I have oftentimes trouble discerning when the show begins because we start the conversation early. But we were talking about that. What frequencies, if you know, were they originally spotlighting? There are so many frequencies you could spotlight when you're searching for signals from space.
Yes. And the times that I've interviewed Seth Shostak over the years, which I have many times for articles in Discover and in an astronomy magazine, we've talked about what frequencies they use. And he tells me they are at SETI. They are bombarded all the time from good-meaning, well-meaning people who are sending in suggestions. Why not try this frequency? Why not listen in that frequency? And he says they do, because Valerie mentioned the 21-centimeter bandwidth that neutral hydrogen gives off, so that when you want to trace our own galaxy's spiral arms, that's what you want to tune into, because that'll let you trace them out where they are. Well, isn't, if that's the case and we know that, wouldn't aliens know that too throughout the universe? So shouldn't we use that wavelength to send signals, because that's a likely wavelength for them to be listening to? Mm-hmm. And others have suggested, why not pi? Why not use 3.14159265358973283462664?
As you keep going another 6 minutes, the show will be over.
I wondered how far I could take that.
No.
Without you stopping me, that is. Why not use that? Because surely every alien in the universe will know the value of pi. circles are everywhere. They're not must be everywhere. They are everywhere. So the ratio of a diameter to a circle is the same everywhere. Let's use that as a frequency. So to answer the caller, yes, there are some obvious choices, and they're being used.
I think that was I was the caller.
That was Ray.
I was the caller in this case. I'm on the air.
Did you bring it up?
Yes.
Yeah. I was just going to say they use water too a lot because if we assume that we need water to survive, if there are other alien creatures that are similar to us, they might emit at the frequency of H2O as well. So that's one of the other big ones that they look for.
It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. The number is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Gimo in Kingston. You're on.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
You bet.
I took a class in astronomy back in college, and I know a few things, some words that you guys are talking about. But my basic question is, the James Webb Telescope is a fairly recent new telescope up in space.
Yeah.
And I've seen some photos that it's put out the last few months. My question is, are there plans for an even better telescope, or is there even such a thing as a better telescope?
Oh.
Or is James Webb like the final,
There's always something better in store.
Yep.
All right. I've not heard of anything larger. I mean, James Webb is so large. Hubble only had a 96-inch mirror. And I'd love a telescope with a 96-inch mirror. But in terms of the colossuses, if that's the right plural of that word, around the world, that was smallish, Hubble. So James Webb has remedied that. And it's so good. It's being so profuse in its output. That I don't know if anyone's looking ahead because it's so grand that we have that right now.
Oh, no, they're totally looking ahead. The next big one is the Habitable Worlds Observatory, and I just had to look up the size, but it's basically Hubble, but 8 meters wide.
Wow.
As a thought or as an actual plan?
No, they're actively planning for it and funding for it right now. So.
But we have the Drake, too. That's X-ray?
Not Chandra's up there now.
There's an X-ray telescope. Isn't it apples and oranges, though? I mean,
oh, definitely. Webb, yeah, I mean, X-ray is totally different than optical or infrared. Yeah.
I mean, Webb is infrared, right?
Mostly, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so Webb is like the big one now. And then the next one, because we're thinking about trying to replace Hubble, that would be the Habitable Worlds Observatory.
Oh, yeah, let's have that. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Mark in Great Barrington. Mark, you're on.
Hey, guys, a great show. I got a question. I've been hearing stuff lately about putting data centers in space, and I'm wondering if that's just futuristic or is it a real possibility?
I haven't heard any practical plans. I mean, I suppose we could put up satellites that would store data, but why, I guess, would be my question. We can transmit the information just fine through them. I don't know. Bob, go ahead.
Well, one of the issues is to separate things that are being speculated about or talked about or, fantasized about. Hey, why not do this? Why not do that? With actual real money, real plans, like having an educational or government-based consortium-based that has the funds for it and are actually devising real plans with some tentative future date. So there's a difference because just coming up with wish lists and theoretical things, some of them very fanciful, happens all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mark.
All right. Still pie in the sky.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll put it on the moon someday.
I think that's what they want to do.
Yeah, that could be. But then you'd have a weird delay. Like, you got to remember, the moon is like a second in light speed time away. So, 2 second minimum, 1 second there, 1 second back. So anything you tried to do, like imagine using the internet with a 2 second delay.
Yeah.
In today's time, that would drive you insane.
But then again, you go back 30 years and you'd be very, very happy about that.
I remember AOL and, the load bar for my games. I learned how to say the alphabet backwards while I waited for games to load. Was my childhood.
Excuse me, I still use AOL.
Do you really?
Yes, I really do.
Wow.
Oh my gosh.
What a lot.
Yeah, the only one that still uses, by the way, has a modem in service in Kingston that if your internet fails, you can actually do a dial up with that. With all those things.
All right, Michael wants to know, are we moving toward Andromeda or is Andromeda overtaking us?
70 miles a second. We're coming closer together.
Yeah, it's like it's a mutual pull. You know, you kind of have to think of it that way.
And how long will it be before we join together as one?
They say a few billion years. But the latest calculations show that we may be slightly at an angle and we might just miss each other.
Yeah, that would be better.
If we did hit, doesn't that put all the timeline for the any of the stars' lives in our...
No. There's no problem because stars are separated by such distances. Picture the dot on top of the letter I, where you rank it a dot. And now picture another dot that's about 4 miles away. And you have a good scale model of the distance between stars relative to their sizes. So each galaxy are like dots over the letter I, separated by 4 miles. Now you take two such systems, pass them through each other, and it's been calculated that the odds are great that not a single star from either galaxy will collide with a star from the other galaxy.
With that. I mean, we have interstellar comets that they shouldn't be here that often, and yet we've had three within the last 10 years.
Yeah, but it didn't collide with anything, did it?
Okay. Bob, if people want to find out what's going on with you, what is going on with you?
Well, the next thing will be Alaska for the Northern Lights, which we do every year and do some amazing things in Alaska.
And you do a tour?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How do people find out about it?
Special interest tour. Just use my name, Bob Berman Tours.
Bob Berman.
And that'll go to the right place.
And Valerie, what tours are you leading?
Tours of the night sky and the planetarium, right? Yeah. We'll start planetarium shows again in February. At SUNY Oneonta.
Right.
And observatory open house is going to be in March. So look for those dates soon.
Well, enjoy your time off in the meantime.
Thank you.
Support comes from Open Door Bookstore on Gift Gallery. Holiday gifts with books, jewelry, personal and home accessories, supporting local artisans and artisans from around the world on J Street, opendoor-bookstore.com. Albany Wine and Dine for the Arts, presenting the Albany Chefs Food and Wine Festival January 22nd through 24th, featuring tastings, seminars, slider slam, and battle of the bartenders, albanywinefest.com/2026. And Canvas and Clothier, a micro department store in downtown Poughkeepsie with a coffee shop, home goods, and clothing for women and men made in the USA, a new satellite store in Hudson on Warren Street, open every day. Thanks again to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for being here. Thank you for listening. Great calls, great emails, and thank you for those. Sorry if we didn't get to yours. Riley Phillips was our engineer. Thank you, sir. Phone screened by Susie Chekai. I'm Ray Graff. It's Food Friday tomorrow, and we'll welcome back for our final show of 25. Amy Halloran will have a little flower hour. We'll see you, too.